TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Nuclear War and the Devastating Power of Nuclear Weapons. Author Annie Jacobson and Professor Stephen Starr. When Penguin Random House prepared the release of Annie Jacobson's most recent bestseller, Nuclear War, for early 2024, they did not anticipate that it would appear at a time of heightened risk of a nuclear war. The risks include the casual threats of the use of nuclear weapons over Ukraine or in the Middle East, as well as the actual attacks or threats to the nuclear plants in Ukraine and Russia. Annie Jacobson and Professor Stephen Starr explain how nuclear weapons and the highly automated systems that set them off have become so much more deadly than in the early 1990s, when we thought we had ended the Cold War. Annie Jacobson's book is based on dozens of exclusive interviews with military and civilian experts. They built the modern nuclear weapons and launch systems. This is part of an interview at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on March 27, 2024. Here's tech writer Quentin Hardy.
Hello. Discussing the career of Robert Oppenheimer and the gathering of several hundred of the world's most brilliant people at Los Alamos in the mid-1940s to develop the atomic bomb, the physicist Freeman Dyson described it as a Faustian bargain, in which theoretical physicists were given the opportunity to make their ideas and their theories into a concrete reality through the almost unlimited economic resources of the world's greatest economic power. In exchange, they were compelled by this bargain to turn over their results to the world's greatest military power, also supported by the US economy. As a result of that devil's bargain, as we speak today, thousands of people are standing by to commit global genocide on command. That was our deal with the devil. We've been living with it for almost 8 decades, 24/7, every minute, thousands of people standing by, committed to total nuclear warfare if the necessity occurs. Now, most of us have some dim understanding of that destructive potential. We hear about the presidential football with the missile launch codes, or with the silos of devastating rockets in North Dakota, planes and submarines flying nonstop, under the water, seeking, protecting, deterring. What very few of us know is what an elaborate and terrifying system of global destruction the United States has built and improved upon for 8 decades. In Nuclear War, a Scenario, Annie Jacobson takes us through this little known and critical system of deterrence, and failing deterrence, global annihilation. It is a shocking and fascinating read, an essential text in any discussion of where this Faustian bargain has taken us and what the United States might do in the future. Annie Jacobson, welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's begin by talking a little bit what led you to this book, and perhaps in particular, the character of John H. Rubel.
So as a national security reporter, an investigative journalist, I write about war and weapons, national security and secrets. Six previous books, imagine the number of my sources, 100 per book. And how many of those individuals said to me with a kind of, you know, prideful chest swelling, "Oh, my life's work was dedicated to preventing nuclear World War III." And during the last administration, the fire and fury rhetoric of it all, I got to thinking, what would happen if deterrence failed? What would happen if prevention failed? And I took that question to the highest level, upper echelon national security sources that I had, and others, and I asked them exactly that. And that was the impetus for this book. And of course, John Rubel was a rare individual, now deceased, who left behind a memoir that gave a tiny glimmer of what a nuclear war plan would actually be like, because those are jealously guarded secrets within the United States government. And I was able to springboard that into a whole lot of other questions.
And of course, in the present moment, it involves satellites and other players that Mr. Rubel never envisioned being part of the system. The system has grown and grown and grown.
That was one of the first of many jaw-dropping realizations reporting this book, was that nuclear war is a system of systems. It is built upon this idea that deterrence will hold. And to have found, as I did, the deputy general of Stratcom saying to a group of sort of insiders on the record, you know, if deterrence fails, it all unravels. And that unraveling is what I portray in Nuclear War Scenario. It's one by one by one. And I'm talking about seconds and minutes of action, not days and weeks. That was really what got me immediately thinking about how to frame the book and how to report it as the ticking clock scenario that it is. As you know, it's three acts. In 72 minutes, it's over.
Ah, you went to the spoiler.
Yes. But I, you know, we have to go right there, because no, it's urgent.
It's in the intro, and that's the shocking thing. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the aftermath is a nuclear winter and radioactive drift, but undoing perhaps 50,000 years of human civilization in, 72 minutes?
72 minutes is sort of when all the last weapons land on the United States.
Yes. And
essentially, that's where recorded history ends.
Yeah. There's no telling how anything could happen after that, because as you state, even nuclear winter was only thought about 30 years after the fact. No one knows what the real knock-on effect of several thermonuclear weapons going off at the same time might be. And yet, you spend many pages on those effects, but far more on the bureaucracy itself. And you thank or acknowledge interviews with dozens, scores of people involved in the system. Two questions. One, as best we understand it, how many other countries have systems like this?
Well, of course, as you said in your intro, this all began with two superpowers, the United States and then Soviet Russia. The system was set up to sort of have both sides pointing their guns, pointing their missiles at one another, with the idea of deterrence being, don't you dare launch or else we will all die. And that's how we get MAD, mutual assured destruction. But as you correctly point out, things have changed, and there are now 9 nuclear armed nations.
That we know of.
I would be relatively certain that that's what it is right now. I mean, there are an enormous number of people, very capable people, working on these issues in non-proliferation, keeping track of things. I always remember to mention the Federation of American Scientists. They have a team called that puts together the nuclear notebook. And so they keep track of the warheads, which, because of treaties, get reported. There is, of course, an exception, and the exception is North Korea, the incredibly dangerous nuclear-armed nation. And that is, of course, why I chose to thread North Korea into the scenario the way in which I did.
I was rather shocked that you have this FEMA document that says you can protect your family from a nuclear explosion. And I looked it up. It was published in 2019. This isn't some comical 1960s duck and cover fantasy.
You're absolutely right. And if you look, and of course, I reproduce that in the book, because it contradicts itself in every measure. And that is one of the most horrifying things about nuclear war, is that there is no way to survive a nuclear war. It no matter how it starts, it only escalates toward nuclear Armageddon. And so all of the things that are said in that single sheet, you know, kind of a tear sheet of what to do in the event of a nuclear war, are absurd because it could perhaps save you in one situation and kill you in another situation. You know, go into your basement or don't go into your basement. Well, it depends where that blast is when you are in your basement. Mm. And these, of course, are the details that I take the reader through with, I think, horrific specificity, but important specificity, because the point of all this is to demonstrate that the time to have conversations about all of this is now, not later. Later is too late.
Mm. Well, as a reader, I can assure you, specific, horrific, you checked both boxes. Don't worry. Let me ask you, as a reader, I'm with it for a few hours. As a writer, you're with it for a year. What's it like to be in this bureaucracy and spend 20 or 30 years inside planning or actually acting in nuclear war scenarios? What's it like to spend your life dedicated to a group of missile silos or bases or hidden command centers across the American prairie?
Mm-hmm. Well, I talk to a lot of people, as you know, and a lot of the, you know, missileers, yes, but really people that are in charge of the policy, people that are in charge of advising the president in the moments after detection that a nuclear missile has come at the United States, because that's really what we're talking about here in a scenario. Mm. It's the fact that an intercontinental ballistic missile, and by the way, most people do not know this, an intercontinental ballistic missile, also known as an ICBM, takes just 30 minutes to get from one side of the world to the next. And so the clock begins ticking then, and the president must make a decision to counterattack with nuclear missiles.
It's a 30-minute trip, but an American satellite has registered it less than a second into its journey, setting in a concatenation across space and the American continent.
You're absolutely right. And so it's like you reverse engineer from that concept of the 30-minute missile to realize this is why the system is set up. We have these incredible satellite systems in space called SBIRS, space-based infrared satellite systems. They're astonishing with their technology. Think about it. They can detect the hot rocket exhaust on an ICBM launch from any enemy armed nation within a fraction of a second. This is remarkable. And this is so that the president can launch his counterattack in minutes afterward. And that's where you begin to realize, I think, you know, all of the people behind the scenes that are rehearsing this 24/7, 365 are acutely aware that deterrence is terrific if it holds. Their job is relatively simple. It is just rehearsing what might happen. But if nuclear war begins, it becomes a sequence of events. A follows B. There is no divergent from that pathway to apocalypse. And that is what is so appalling and remarkable and also worthy of everybody understanding, particularly as we enter into this present time of nuclear saber rattling, which astonishes me every day. I mean, it truly is madness. The world is just one misunderstanding, one technical mistake away from nuclear Armageddon, because once the missiles start flying, and again, SecDef's confirmed this with me, you know, no one is really thinking about what the other nuclear armed nations are thinking as America tries to defend herself in a nuclear counterattack against a rogue nation.
Let's move to the scenario and how it unfolds.
Well, of course, the detection of the nuclear missile is second number one, and things move very quickly thereafter, because, again, what most people don't realize is that the data systems are so fast that they pump data from space to three command systems in the United States in seconds. And these three bunkers are famously, the one in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. It's made many appearances in movies. There's also one beneath the Pentagon. It's called the National Military Command Center. And there's a third bunker beneath STRATCOM, U.S. Strategic Command, the most powerful nuclear agency that almost no one has heard of. And those three centers, the commanders in each of those facilities, within minutes of detecting a nuclear launch, now begins to categorize the missiles and the targets that will be in the continental United States and prepares to tell the president. And that when the president begins to have to make a counterattack decision, as I report in the book, and was also surprised to learn, the president has a 6-minute window. And listeners may ask, well, how does she, you know all these things? Are these from Annie Jacobson's imagination? Everything is sourced in the book to, like, if you go into the notes, you can see where the information comes from. Sometimes I quote people directly, but for example, the 6-minute window to make a decision about launching nuclear Armageddon comes from Ronald Reagan's memoir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's move to the targets, because you choose two very interesting targets here that have extremely different consequences.
The targets that are attacked in the United States, you're referring to.
Correct.
We have the 1 megaton thermonuclear bomb now heading toward Washington, D.C. in the beginning of the unfolding of the war that is immediately detected. And then we have a sneak attack by a submarine-launched ballistic missile on the west coast of the United States. And I did this with very calculated reasons, having discussed the worst case scenarios with national security experts who sit around and worry about these things with good reason. And of course, the technical aspects of it are all sourced through engineers and weapons designers. By the way, Russia and China do regularly. And I show a document in the book that I found at on a budget request for the Defense Department, where they demonstrate exactly that. And so the second target is a nuclear power plant in California. And, you know, when I was writing the book, this was a hypothetical situation. It's called Rule 42 of the Geneva Conventions, Article 15, which says you never strike a nuclear power plant in war. And so I was thinking about a rogue nation going way outside normative behavior and doing that. And that kind of horror is something that the Japanese call the devil scenario, mm-hmm. because they almost experienced it after the tidal wave.
Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's 6 extremely fraught minutes, not just inherently, but while it's in flight, it's unclear whether it will hit New York or Washington, and the president may need to leave. And now there's this threat on Diablo Canyon in California. What does the White House decide to do next, and how does that go?
And again, that was a really interesting series of reporting and a series of conversations that I did with sources to discern in the scenario what would happen. You know, there's a quote from General Hyten, who was STRATCOM commander during the fire and fury rhetoric. Barbara Starr of CNN interviewed him and asked him what would happen. And he said, if, you know, North Korea needs to know that if they send one nuclear missile, we send one. If they send two, we send two. And I sourced that in the book. But taking this question to national security experts, including Bruce Blair, now deceased, but who is pretty much the world's expert on the kind of command and control systems and responses. According to Blair, if North Korea launched one nuclear weapon at the United States, the response would almost certainly be 82 nuclear weapons in response in order to take out North Korea's nuclear command and control. And so that is what happens in the scenario. And then I explain how, you know, and again, another jaw-dropping moment, learning in my reporting that America sends ICBMs out of nuclear, you know, out of our silos in the Midwest that you referred to in the opening statement, that make up 50 of those 82 warheads that will now target North Korea. But what I learned is American ICBMs do not have enough range to fly directly to North Korea without overflying Russia. And that is a disaster waiting to happen. Imagine two nations in as much conflict as Russia and the United States are right now. And America, you know, wanting Russia to assume that 50 nuclear warheads are just going to fly over their country. They are not going to hit the country. That becomes an apocalyptic situation.
That's Annie Jacobson, author of Nuclear War, A Scenario. It is based on dozens of exclusive interviews with military and civilian experts. They built the modern nuclear weapons and launch systems. Professor Stephen Starr teaches the class Environmental Health and Social Effects of Nuclear Weapons at the University of Missouri. Here are excerpts from an interview he gave to Hugo Krueger on February 24, 2023.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I wouldn't have thought of this question had it not been for the Russian-Ukrainian war. You maybe give us a sense of the nuclear weapons and arsenal that is on both sides.
Well, the United States and Russia have about 90% of the nuclear weapons that are in the world today, and there's 12,000 or so of those. So the U.S. and Russia each have about 2,000 nuclear warheads that they can use within the space of an hour. They each have about 1,000 warheads that are at what they call launch-ready status. So they're mounted on top of, they call them delivery systems, but you know, mostly missiles. Russia has non-ballistic missiles now, too, that we have no defense against. But the launch-ready weapons can be launched in a matter of 2 to 15 minutes. 15 minutes are for the subs. The U.S. usually has four subs that are on what they call hard alert status, where they're in a position to launch. You know, the missiles are long enough range that they can even launch them from the port if they want to. That's 4,000 nuclear weapons ready to go, and 4,000 doesn't sound very intimidating, except when you realize that one can set like 390 square kilometers or 150 square miles on fire instantly when it detonates. So.
Right. I mean, is it even a fair comparison to compare today's nuclear weapons to what happened in Hiroshima?
I think it's useful to think about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the two cities that the U.S. dropped the first nuclear weapons were called atomic bombs. But any nuclear weapon is like a small piece of the sun. The larger, the more explosive power, the bigger the yield it is, the larger the fireball and the longer it will last. But the surface of these fireballs are actually hotter than the surface of the sun. And, you know, you really want to keep the sun 92 million miles away from it if you can. So they instantly will set fires over a large area from the heat. You know, if you're directly beneath one, like some of the unfortunate people in Hiroshima, there's photographs of shadows on the sidewalk where they were vaporized from the heat. Hiroshima had about somewhere like 4 to 5 square miles. That was how big the firestorm was. So now those might be called tactical nuclear weapons, although that's kind of a broad, but the strategic nuclear weapons that the U.S. and Russia have at launch ready status, their yield starts out at 100,000 tons of TNT or 100 kilotons, as opposed to 15 at Hiroshima. So instead of a fire zone that's 4 to 5 square miles, you have it like 150 square miles. These are the fires that the nuclear weapons create are called mass fires. We did see some of those in World War II in Dresden and Hamburg with a mass bombing raids where they dropped all the phosphorus and incendiary weapons that set entire cities on fire. When you have a firestorm, all these fires will coalesce into a single gigantic fire. I wrote an article for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists about the effects of I guess you would call it a standard Russian warhead. It's 800 kilotons, 800,000 tons of TNT. They have about 500 of those ready to go at any given time. That description, you know, if your readers want to look that article up, it's called What Would Happen If an 800 Kiloton Warhead Dropped on Manhattan, so that you can get more details. But that fire zone that's created in there is, within about 2 minutes, you'll have 300 mile an hour winds coming in all from all sides of it, because it's like a chimney effect. You have winds going up that fast, and that causes all the fires to coalesce into a gigantic fire where the air temperatures in the zone are about 400 to 500 degrees Fahrenheit. They're above the boiling point of water, so no one in the zone is going to live. If you go down into a shelter, it's going to cook you like you're in an oven, and it'll use all the oxygen up. These zones are so hot that you can't even take a tracked vehicle into them, you know, several days afterwards. So it burns everything remotely flammable in that zone. That's one weapon. If you think of a war fought with hundreds or thousands of these weapons, then you can, scientific studies that I talk about on my website, they came up with the term nuclear winter. They estimate 150 to 180 million tons of smoke would be created by these firestorms if all the U.S. and Russia got into it and detonated their launch-ready weapons. And this smoke acts like a solar collector. When the sun strikes it, it heats it, and it causes it to rise above the lower atmosphere, the troposphere, into the stratosphere. And once it's above cloud level, it can't be rained out. And there's high winds in the stratosphere. If you've ever flown on an airliner, you know, you can, depends which way you're going, east or west, but the winds up there will push the smoke around the earth in about 2 weeks. And then it tends to equilibrate, and it become like a global stratospheric smoke layer.
You know, by the time you have the smoke level, I mean, assuming we are nuts to launch all of these weapons, wouldn't the life on Earth be burned to death anyways? I mean, would there still be anything left for the smoke to kill?
You know, the surface areas that are affected by the direct effects of the weapons, the thermal and blasts and immediate fallout are, you know, there would be hundreds of thousands of square miles that would be on fire probably. But that's not, you know, the Earth is a very big place. But what the studies found, what astounded the scientists, was that the smoke, once it gets up in the stratosphere, can block enough sunlight that they estimate up to 70% of the sunlight in the northern hemisphere would be blocked. And because the smoke's heated, it will remain there for up to 10 years. At the same time, the smoke gets up to about the temperature of the boiling point of water there, and that helps destroy the stratospheric ozone layer, which is a protective layer that blocks the ultraviolet light from coming down. That will eventually replace itself as the smoke dissipates, but it would be very dark, and you could still get a horrible sunburn from the UVB. But the main thing is that this loss of warming sunlight would cause average temperatures to fall below the coldest temperatures in the last ice age 18,000 years ago. And this would happen in a matter of weeks. The average daily temperatures in central North America and central Eurasia would be below freezing every day for up to 3 years. And it would be too cold to grow crops for many years.
That was Professor Stephen Starr. He teaches at the University of Missouri. His most recent book is Nuclear High Altitude Electromagnetic Pulse, A Mortal Threat to the U.S. Power Grid and U.S. Nuclear Power Plants. Before that, you heard from Annie Jacobson, author of the New York Times bestseller, Nuclear War, A Scenario. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.